This is 69, the podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. 69 has been covering the digital signage industry since the dawn of man, first online and now as a podcast. This podcast gives me the time to really talk to people about technology and issues, get past the PR and jargon, and into what stuff actually means. I try to help listeners understand why they should care. The podcasts are free and I try to get a new one out weekly, but I travel a lot so sometimes I'll miss a week. The 69 podcast has been gratefully sponsored and supported since the start by Jeremy Gavin and the fine folks at ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. ScreenFeed makes beautiful looking, totally automated content for signage and digital out-of-home networks. Check them out at screenfeed.com. Advocates for Connected Experiences is an umbrella organization created several months ago that pulls together the people and shared interests of a variety of organizations that deliver experiences to guests. That can be in retail and museums, commercial properties, or theme parks, for example. The short form for the group is ACE, and it was pulled together and somewhat driven by the Digital Signage Federation. Notably past and present board members like Kim Cerubi, Beth Warren, and Laura Davis-Taylor. One of the early efforts from ACE has been a monthly series of online discussions about important topics that pull together top people from member organizations. The most recent one was about connected experiences now and post-COVID, as we all hope there is soon a post-COVID. I was the moderator for the discussion, and this is the audio track, which is roughly 1 hour. The panelists include folks from SHOP, SEGD, Geopath, the DSF, the Location-Based Marketing Association, Blue Telescope, the Experiential Designers and Producers Association, Retail Touchpoints, and AVIXA. That's a lot of voices, and you won't always know who is saying what, but the content is worth any confusion you might experience. Enjoy.
Right, I would get everybody to introduce themselves.
I wanted to start off just with some numbers that were passed along to me that I think are really interesting. One of them says only a slim majority, the 54% of consumers, feel safe going into a store right now. That's according to Deloitte's research. 3/4 of Americans are trying new shopping behaviors, including new methods, brands, and places, with the intention of sticking with them in the long term. That's from McKinsey. This is really interesting. The average basket size of retail customers with appointments is approximately 5 times that of shoppers who just came into a store. And finally, 2/3 of shoppers would rather use their phone than something in the store that's based on a touch device, like a touch screen. So things are definitely changing out there, and we've already seen adjustments, and that's just going to continue. So with that, I thought I'd go around the Hollywood Squares layout that I have in front of me here and ask everybody to introduce themselves, and I'll start with Todd Dittman.
Hi, everybody. I'm Todd Dittman. I'm executive director with Shop Environments Association. We're a trade group made up of store fixture manufacturers and retail designers and POP producers and visual merchandisers. And our focus is on the customer experience.
Great. Sabelle.
I am Sabelle Jones. I'm CEO of SUGD, which is the Society of Experienced Graphic Designers. And we're an organization of EGD, digital media exhibition, and experience designers.
Great. Joey.
Hi there. My name is Joey Lloyd. I am the Senior Director of Communications for AVIXA. We are the Audio, Visual, and Integrated Experience Association.
All right. Debbie.
Hey there. I'm Debbie House. I'm the Executive Director of Content for Retail Touchpoints. We're a digital media group, and we also are in the midst of getting our first virtual retail innovation conference completed. It's going to be October 13th and 14th, and we have a pretty exciting agenda already in place.
Great. Brian.
I'm Brian Zermos, past president of SUGD, also a current board member, and also run a digital experience agency called OpenEye Global.
Trent.
Hello, I'm Trent Oliver. I'm the principal and managing director of Blue Telescope. We create interactive multimedia experiences that expand the human experience. We work in museums, theme parks, and executive briefing centers, a little light retail, but we have strong opinions.
All right, Dasher.
Hi, I'm Dasher Lowe. I'm the executive director of the Experiential Designer and Producers Association. Our association is comprised of folks in the experiential and face-to-face marketing world, a lot of trade shows and such. Our members are typically the designers, builders, as well as suppliers to those environments.
Kim Frank.
Hey, hi. Kim Frank. I'm president of Geopath.
We are the nonprofit trade association that's responsible for providing data solutions to the out-of-home and digital out-of-home industry.
Asif.
Hi, Asif Khan. I'm the founder and president of the Location-Based Marketing Association. So we're focused on people counting and location data indoors and outdoors, and bringing the industry together around that. And I'm also the head of a tech startup called Ground Level Insights, which is doing a lot of work in using location data, especially in COVID times, for monitoring economic recovery and COVID compliance.
And finally, Beth Warren, who's on the board of Digital Science Federation, along with myself.
Yes. Hi, everybody. Beth Warren. I am SVP of Marketing and our retail practice at Creative Realities. We are a digital signage, digital solutions company. And I help our retail kind of contingent and brands figure out how to leverage intelligent, responsive, and aware solutions, in particular now during COVID. And we also have a line of safe space solutions, which we're utilizing to help front of house and back of house situations so that the world can hopefully get back inside with confidence.
Right. All right. Kind of an open question for everybody. I don't have any particular victim I'm going to pick on right away, but has all of the changes that have happened, were they unexpected changes, or were they changes that were going to happen anyways and things have just accelerated because of COVID?
Yeah, I can start off. I think it's the latter point that you made. I think it's stuff that with technology that was coming into the stores already, but it got sped up because of the necessity of everything that was going on around. And what I've seen is like one of the biggest things impacted has been the inventories in the stores, that, you know, the retail was going to a smaller footprint by design, and this is really pushing them in that direction. They're actually trying to be smarter about the flow of people through the stores, and they're trying to be more technology driven to control the inventories. And maybe an unintended consequence right now has been a lot of out of stocks, because if you were not an essential retail, then you know, you laid off a lot of your folks who were doing the ordering, and so now there's a long cycle to catch up, and you know, some of the consumers are, you know, not walking away with their goods anymore. They have to, you know, go home and order it online, so that's having an impact too.
Dave,
Sorry, Beth.
I think the role of mobile has really evolved. Also, maybe I was reading your mind, Brian. I don't know.
Yeah.
But you know, where
a scary place.
Well, right. where retailers were like kind of afraid of this, right? I think now they're embracing it because customers feel comfortable with this being their primary navigation tool and now their primary payment tool. So this whole notion of contactless, I think, has been embraced a little bit more by retailers. We're hearing that, and I'm seeing it in the just in my everyday desk research that we're staying on top of. So I think that mobile has accelerated in new, fresh ways, and that's actually a good thing. So,
and I was just gonna. Oh, sorry, Dave. I don't know. I'm just gonna add a little bit to that, kind of with the mobile, but I think to a degree, some were caught off guard, especially when a lot of consumers are turning towards order online and come to the store and pick up. There wasn't a really good process that a lot of retailers had in place to support that or to assist customers in understanding how do they come to the curb, how do they pick up, where do they go in the store. Many of times I even got sort of lost in the shuffle of trying to figure out where do I need to go to get items that I picked up on store. And so there's been a lot that either rethinking and how they use the mobile to perform that transaction, or rethinking just the overall experience of where they define that area in the store. So I think there's some that unfortunately got caught off guard by the rush. And I think to Todd's point too, got caught off guard by people wanting to come to the store, but just not having a good experience and how to actually pick up the items that they ordered online.
Trent, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I think we definitely saw part of this coming. In New York City, retail establishments were closing like crazy. Amazon was winning, you know, online ordering was winning. Shopping malls were not doing well and having to, like the American Dream model, put in theme parks. And I think that that will just keep going, that to shop, to do the basic stuff, well, you can do that online. In order for me to go somewhere, it better be something of an experience that I feel is worth it. You know, that said, now that we're in COVID, it better be an experience that is safe, but it has to be a different experience for just shopping.
Yeah, some of the stuff I read suggested that consumers are no longer just going shopping. They have a mission. They have a list. They're going to do this. They're going to get in, get out. So if you want to have deliver an experience, you better really think that through, and it actually better be an experience and not just stuff.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think when this is done, we will be creating better experiences, museums, retail, whatever it is, because in order to woo people back, it better be impressive.
We had been kind of heading towards this depersonalized experience when it came to shopping and dining. I think a generational thing where people were ordering Grubhub rather than going to speak to somebody at a restaurant to order. Just like having that one step removed from an actual person anyway, especially in New York, where we're enabled to do that because we can get anything through an app without having to talk to a person. And I mean, this is just throwing that out there because I do watch my staff, how they would prefer to have somebody bring McDonald's up to our office than to actually go to the McDonald's. But then does that then end up coming around after all of this goes over? Are we going to end up craving to actually interact with humans and see humans, or does this push us further away, even further from having a detached experience in stores and in restaurants and in bars?
I think that's where there's something really interesting to be happening. I've actually ventured out in the past couple of weeks because I've said, you know what, I'm just going to go to the store, right? Like I need five things. I know what I need. Rather than pay the extra delivery fee, I'm going to go. But the challenge is that the experience, once you get there, it is hodgepodge. There's not enough signage to tell you what's going on, who's in there, how many people. You don't know clean from dirty unless you're standing there watching and waiting. And the PPE and the mask wearing is ad hoc at best. I think this not only accelerated the technology that was to come and the usage of mobile and everything that you guys have already talked about, but I think, you know, what was it, 3 to 5 years ago, we were all talking about the retail apocalypse. And then it was like, oh, no, it really wasn't that. But this has truly accelerated the need for a specialized experience, because if I can get it on Amazon, if I can get it delivered to my door, I am sure as hell not going in your store.
I just wanted to add that on a positive note, I've been impressed with some of the retail companies that have been able to pivot quickly and add some of these experiences like curbside pickup and buy online pickup in store. Because, we see so many retail companies that are now declaring bankruptcy and closing their stores. And so I want to just, give a shout out to companies like I interviewed, Party City, for example, that just pivoted real quick. And to your point, Joey, it wasn't a perfect experience when they first did it, but they got themselves out there and they tried some things, and then they adjusted as they went along. And I agree that there are, a lot of imperfect experiences out there, but, I have to, give credit to those that are trying, because they want to survive.
I wouldn't think of a company like Party City being a big innovator. What were they doing that was so impressive?
Well, they implemented curbside pickup very, very quickly. They also partnered with Instacart as well as Hertz, I believe, a rental car company. And I believe the CEO or the president of the company had previously had a relationship with Hertz, and they were, you know, they were hanging around employees not doing anything. And so they partnered with Instacart and Hertz and others eventually, and were able to get deliveries going. And people still, you know, were having birthdays, having graduations, having celebrations. They also were able to use data analysis to figure out, to make sure they were getting the right types of cars there. So if you had a, you know, 50 balloons that you were sending to someone's home, you didn't have, you know, a little Hyundai coming to pick up that delivery, you know, so they were able to, you know, figure out how to, right, exactly. Yeah. Can't have drones delivering big groups of balloons. So they really were able to pivot quickly and, you know, help people still have happiness and celebration in their lives.
Sibel, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, it's interesting. We're preparing for a symposium we're having in September, and one of the designers said that they're actually calling it performance art. That going back to, Dave, what you were talking about, people's fear, that the retailers and the experiences who are successful are actually making it kind of an event to show the customers how they are preparing for them, how they're sanitizing. And so you look at Whole Foods, where they had, you know, they were taking temperatures of employees before they went in. After each customer, they do this big spray down and, you know, and the way that they've queued people. And I was recently in Maine that had just opened up their very small, you know, like small community retail. And they had it so beautifully. It was literally choreographed, where each of these stores you came in, you had outside, they were counting the people who came in. They had a sanitization station beautifully curated. They had cards and, you know, even in these very small shops. And so I think we are going to see a differentiator of those who are doing in-person retail, where if they really stand out and they go above and beyond as to how they kind of curate this performance to prove that they're clean and they're safe, you can definitely see a difference in how the customers respond to that.
Is that a big part of it, to kind of show that, hey, we're doing this because we care about you, as opposed to we're doing this because this is mandated and it's a pain in the ass, but hang on a second, I got to wipe this down?
It really is. And the one thing I was thinking about, I was actually thinking of how we apply this just even on our association is, you know, you have all these brands that you're interfacing with, and we're no longer competing in our same brand silos, because any experience during COVID, if you are gracious and generous and patient, you're going to stand out in that person's very stressful day, right? And they're going to remember that qualitative experience. So, you know, I think we can look one way, which is that we have these digital interfaces, whether it's pre-ordering or whatever, what's the customer experience of that? But these kind of touch points, which we're really focused on in the experience realm, whether that's museums or retail experiences or you know, placemaking, we are going to bring in a different kind of differentiator to our competition here, I think.
It's purpose-driven. And instead of marketing for marketing's sake or coming up with new ways to expand, somebody or keeping people in the store, it's about tuning into the mission and the reason why, and how technology and the other visual merchandising cues can deliver a purpose beyond just the shop. And I think that's what will, you know, help differentiate.
Asif.
Yeah, a couple of things. So from the Location-Based Marketing Association perspective, certainly within our member base, we've seen accelerations of technologies that were kind of already there, but not really happening at scale. And payments, mobile payments, obviously has already been talked about. But one of the areas we're seeing a lot of movement is in the use of augmented reality as well. A lot of retailers, a lot of brands are starting to kind of think about how they can kind of deliver experiences, you know, using AR or even VR in some cases now that weren't there before. So that's just one area that we're seeing that. But at a broader level, when we look at kind of location data, one of the things that we're seeing is a bit of a shift right now with many of our retail and other consumer-facing business members. sort of kind of pausing in a lot of ways the marketing and ad spend and shifting more towards, you know, safety and internal applications in a lot of ways. And so, for example, using location data to understand what traffic counts look like, but, you know, how that affects planning for staffing levels and other things that we're really seeing kind of manifest. And from, you know, the ground level insights part of my world, my startup business, like we have technologies where, you know, we're doing people counting, or we're using video analytics to do face mask compliance and detection and things like that. And we're really seeing that kind of broadly across many different industries right now. And so I was thinking about what Trent was saying earlier, like one of our clients is a very large art gallery here in Canada. And while, you know, we have, you know, sort of fairly widely dispersed government regulations around mask compliance and capacity restrictions and things like that here in Canada that aren't necessarily the case in the US, we're seeing, you know, many, like this art gallery, for example, their whole reason for engaging with, you know, using the people counting technologies and the video compliance, mask compliance and so on, is as an insurance policy. Like if you ask them, they're like, you know, if we get caught with too many people in the building, or if we get caught with people not wearing masks, the fines are $60,000. And so we'd rather invest in the technology and make sure that, you know, we have a digital data trail to kind of back us up when the inspectors come, you know, that we can say, hey, we're following the rules, we're being a good corporate citizen. But the flip side of that is they're able to kind of position that from a PR point of view as, we're restoring consumer confidence, we're helping, you know, create a safe environment. They're investing in air filtration technologies as well and other things in the art gallery to, you know, kind of create this environment. So I think there's a lot of kind of shift away from just the use of the tech for, you know, sort of data from an advertising and marketing point of view to how do we actually, you know, focus on safety and compliance and, you know, it's some of the same technology just kind of repurposed.
Dasher, I'm curious. With all your member organizations, are they starting to open up and how are they kind of adjusting?
Unfortunately, not a whole lot of opening up going on. We did have a industry-specific show in Orlando a couple weeks ago. Actually, it was back at the end of July, probably a month ago now.
Like a physical show?
Yeah, a physical show.
Wow.
And the show was really specifically around for the industry about how to get back to work with safe practices. So it was Together Again Expo in Orlando, and there was about 1,000 folks that came in person, and then there was several thousand that joined virtually. And it was really for the trade show industry, best practices and that sort of thing of how to pull off a show. So outside of that, you know, there's been a few small local shows here and there, but you know, the industry continues to suffer greatly.
So how would they define trade show experience going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's really from a you know, face-to-face best practices of, there's been a number of guidelines. We helped author some guidelines in addition to IAE as far as best practices with those shows, social distancing, keeping, you know, 6 feet, one-way traffic through aisles, ensuring of face masks, sanitation stations, and that sort of thing. So it's really, you know, about getting that face-to-face back in place during this time.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Gavin, CEO of ScreenFeed. Now, I'm not put off by the fact that you're not listening to this podcast to hear me. Just like audiences to any digital signage, you give your attention to content you find interesting or helpful. That's where my company ScreenFeed comes in. Our sole mission is to make your digital signage network more valuable by making content that is more valuable to your audience. If you'd like to drive more attention to your screens, visit ScreenFeed.com to explore the 75-plus content options we've created to do just that. And then give us a call. Now, back to the podcast.
Was there a moment where they, and I'm sure Joey has thought about this as well, when with these virtual trade shows that are happening, Infocom had Infocom Connected, other trade shows have done virtual ones, and I'm sure there are people that say, well, this is the way it's going to be done from now on, and trade shows will die and all that. And I suspect now that a few of these organizations have done that, and we've all had that experience. We've realized, hey, there's some of this that's good, but trade shows need to happen because you need that face-to-face. You need to see, touch, and feel product, even if you sanitize after. But you, one can't just flat out replace the other.
Right. I mean, there's a number of, you know, I guess the, you know, the buzz is that these hybrid events that are happening, well, virtual right now, but hybrid of virtual and digital along with the face-to-face. You know, our industry is primarily made on that face-to-face side. A lot of our members have pivoted and they're doing some things, you know, of designing virtual booths and that, but there's, like you said, there's nothing that can replace that face-to-face connection. And we're hearing it. We're hearing it from, you know, our the end customers that are saying, you know, it's great to be able to have, while everything's shut down, you know, opportunity to do some of these virtual things. But, you know, I was talking to a medical equipment salesperson the other day, and they said, you know, I'm selling via Zoom, and I don't know if someone's engaged or not. I can't see if they're actually listening or engaging with my product. He said, there's nothing that's going to replace that face-to-face sales piece of it. And while, you know, everybody's limping through with the digital or virtual side of it, it's not replacing the face-to-face piece of it. So at least we're, you know, our industry, we feel strongly that, you know, that's a critical component, because if it's not there, then we're not around as an industry.
Right. Trent?
What I find amazing is that there are so many people, so many groups that are saying, oh, here's our virtual booth, instead of, it's a different experience. We need to look at this as, you know, TV isn't radio, internet and computers aren't TV. Online and a virtual trade show, I don't even know why we have booths. It's silly. It's like nobody can walk through. What is that experience? That experience has to shift and change to be something different, so that when we do go back to in-person, it's additive, not instead of. Mm-hmm. I really think we need to rethink the whole experience. If the experience is I want you to go through something, yeah, it's got to be a little more than Zoom. I think, you know, we've got to come up with microsites on steroids of different ways of interacting and involving people and responding to them, and not trying to push them through, you know, here's what we used to do, because it just is a poor substitute.
I think, Trent, you focused in on something that's really important, which is the additive nature of it. We were one of the first to try to pull off a fully virtual event, and there were absolute wins, and there were things that we definitely learned and we'll have to figure out how to overcome in the future. But I think the silver lining that has come out of this is we started off as a group, and I don't mean just Avixo or Infocom, you know, really regretting the fact that there was no physical show. And I think what we've heard across the board is that people are finding the silver lining in virtual and digital, in the same way that retailers for years have been able to fully track e-commerce and understand their customers and their engagement path. We're learning how to do that with events in a new way. And it is about being additive, because we have yet to figure out the true networking aspect, the ad hoc amazing meetings that just happen in the middle of the hallway. Brian's my favorite of all of that, because usually I catch him from, you know, 100 feet away and I scream and I'm like, hey, you know, in some international city. You know, it's hard to make that happen at a virtual event. But it has also brought us together as a community. That, I think, was probably one of the most amazing things that we found with Infocom Connected, was the fact that a North American show, a primary North American show, had a 40% global audience. And so it was really amazing to be able to bring that group together. So it's about additive. It's about finding some of those silver linings, because it's never going to be the replacement. And I think everybody's sick of saying the new normal, or when it comes back, or it used to be, right? It's about figuring out where we are today.
Sibel.
I want to add on that too, Joey and Trent, because we just finished up, well, tomorrow we'll finish up a month-long symposium. And one of the things that we seeing is that we're able to get thought leaders that we probably would not have been able to get. So you know, when you have this demand of you have to be in this place at a certain time, you're always competing with that person's full-time job. We had a gentleman from the UK who's working with the circular design economy. And then we had a digital artist that was in Malibu and they met. And I find that some of these experiences are even more enriching are the things that are behind the Zoom before we're about to go on to the performance and people connecting in different ways. And that's unique. And I think it's the one upside of where we are. And so is there a way to create that as a different kind of experience? But I agree wholeheartedly, Trent. We shouldn't try to replicate something that's an in-person and just duplicate that to be virtual. I think this is our opportunity to really think that customer experience in a different way. And we have to experiment, and now's the time to do it.
Ryan, you wanted to chime in?
Yeah, I just gonna say, I mean, I love the word experiment that it's being used, because I feel like we're in a really good time now where we're allowed to experiment, and we're learning a lot online, and we're learning a lot by conversing with our colleagues. And I think back to customer experience and in the physical retail is that there's no real wrong or right answer at this time. You know, we have this opportunity to experiment. I mean, from SCDD, we're seeing it with museums that are starting to open in New York City. You know, there's some good examples of ones like Cooper Hewitt and the Liberty Science, the Liberty Statue of Liberty Museum and all those that are opening is that, you know, they're trying different things. And I think they're trying to see what works, and they're trying to understand what people will react to. And I think if we don't take advantage of this opportunity now, you know, we're going to be facing a bigger crisis of not really knowing what a good customer experience is when things do start to open back up. So I love this opportunity now that all of us can really experiment and talk about the failures and talk about the wins, because that's the only way that we get to this point of having a really flushed out customer experience, no matter what environment we're designing for.
It seems like this whole situation has maybe not mainstream, but started to mainstream some technologies that have been touted and floated in stores and tried for a long time, but never really gone anywhere. As you've mentioned, AR via mobile. And I'm curious about that, but also with Todd and Debbie, one of the things I read was about appointments and how appointments is a big thing. It gives you personalization, but it also produces results. Is that workable in a lot of retail settings to schedule times to come in and do all that?
I think some retailers are hesitant to push for that in some ways. I mean, I think that the statistic that the basket size goes up significantly is really relevant. And so wow. I think that they're going to, they feel like they want to make sure that people can feel like if they want to just decide at the last minute they want to come, you know, to a store, that they can do that as well. So I think, you know, it's definitely going to be a combination of things. There's some technologies that retailers are using to, you know, be able to be at the exits and track the number of people that are coming, that are in the store, and the number that are leaving. And it also combines, I forget what the technology is, but it also combines people who have appointments scheduled as well, so that right. You can keep good track, keep the store safe, and also be able to track, you know, so you have the right number of people in the store at a given time. I did hear from a few that they were hesitant to go all in, I think, on the appointment, because it's a little bit restrictive. So being able to do a modification, a hybrid again model of that, I think is probably what's going to work best for certain retailers. And it also depends on the type of retailer, right? If it's a high-end luxury retailer, they're probably more likely to want to do that kind of appointment thing. If it's Target, they won't.
Right. You know, so. Chanel is doing it. They're a client of ours, and they've done appointment setting and continue to do that because it's high-end luxury. But also another client of ours, Ryder Trucks, Ryder Rental, because it's the way the the transactional experience of that and the volume coming in, they have also found that appointment settings help create social distance, and it helps, just sort of enrich the service experience as well. So some categories, yes, some others that are very mass would be restrictive for sure.
So I'm not going to be able to make an appointment at Costco?
Maybe not.
Because I'd like that.
I would concur with everybody that's already spoken about this. You know, we saw, I think it was Macy's in New York, that really took a strategic approach to personalization, you know, to address a whole trend. This is all prior to COVID. And they would do the private appointments. They would do the, they did things with their fitting rooms that were really personalized, and they did all that. But that was based on a specific strategy towards personalization. I don't know that it's the same kind of thing with when you're talking about safety. And if it's actually at a larger scale like that. So I think there would be some challenges to it.
Kim, I'm curious, because your organization tracks audiences, tracks movement, I know you've pushed out regular updates, so to speak, on movement of Americans and where it was at back in March and April and so on, and you had a dip and then accelerated again. Where are we at now? Are we kind of back to normal in how people move around?
Yeah, it's funny because people don't actually believe the data that we're putting out now because it actually looks so positive. But a lot of the folks that I deal with are based in New York, which is a much different experience than the vast bulk of the rest of the country. I think as of last week, we were at 95% to 96% of normal travel.
Wow.
Distance. That doesn't mean, though, that people are traveling the same way that they used to. Like, rush hour is not a thing in the same way it used to be. People are traveling in off hours. People are running all of their errands on the weekends versus doing one stop here, one stop there throughout the week. We also see a lot of people doing road trips rather than flying places, which is clocking miles up. So there have been changes in the way we move, but the actual quantification of movement has kind of returned to normal. Something else that we're seeing is that the number of people who are moving is lower. So we used to see like 85% of people on an average day would leave their home. That has dropped. So we're like 75, 76, 77%. So about 10% of people aren't leaving their house daily who would have before.
They're working from home.
Yeah, I think it's because they're doing their trips in a more condensed way where they'll go out and they'll get everything done while they're out in one day versus doing things. It's certainly changed. We're trying to pay attention to what of those trends are temporary and which ones are going to have longer term impacts. Something else we're looking at right now is people moving their home locations. So there have been a lot of moves that have been temporary, where if I don't need to be in the office, does it matter where I live? So maybe I'll go live with my mom and help her, or move out. I have an employee who moved to Virginia to his family's farm because it's just a nicer place to be than Brooklyn right now. Do those people then come back, or does this have a longer implication on populations in cities and places like that? So something we're taking a look at right now is how long are these temporary moves going to last?
Let's see, if you mentioned with your startup that you're looking at how consumers move around venues, has that changed as well? Do people shop differently? Are the dwell times different?
Yeah, in many ways, yes. I mean, I think that, we're using video analytics for social distancing and mask compliance. But one of the things that, if it wasn't COVID times, we would be using the same technologies for path and dwell and demographic analysis. And so one of the things that we do see is that, businesses are trying to enforce, especially in large footprint retail, social distancing. And so the dwell times are, much higher in certain parts of the store than they were before, but mostly because they're just trying to, make sure people aren't, are moving at a certain pace. Right. And so I think, you're seeing a lot of things like that. The traffic numbers are nowhere what they were before, but again, because it's being controlled. Like, so we have businesses where, you know, you're not allowed to have more than 50 people in the building at a time. And so, you know, there's people waiting outside. There's, you know, sort of real time monitoring of traffic coming in. And then sort of the sort of staging of how that traffic flows throughout the actual store or the business as well. So 100%. I think it's all changed. The metrics don't make any sense now in comparison to the metrics before. You can't correlate it because there's it just doesn't work. And yet I think that you know, this idea of, you know, the pickup and delivery services, the you know, how you take the data about what's going on inside of the business and visualize that externally on digital signage or screens or things like that is becoming really important, right? So we're seeing a lot of businesses that we work with who are using us for safety and counting and those kinds of things. We're also taking the numbers of how many people are in the store at any given time and then posting that on a digital screen viewable externally, so that people outside can know what wait times look like or things like that as well. So there's all kinds of combinations of things happening.
How with all this technology, like what you just described, how do venue operators, retailers, people who run facilities and so on, who may be applying this stuff, how do they rationalize, okay, this is interesting, I could use it, but I could use it right now, as opposed to I'm not sure I need this a year from now. So how do they strike that balance?
I think it's you know, there's two ways to kind of look at it right now. So we end up in just lots of discussions about CapEx versus OpEx on how these things are priced and structured. You know, about the investment now versus the investment over time. And then I think what we've tried to do with Ground Level and what, you know, we're encouraging companies within the LBMA to think about is not just building solutions that are, you know, help with COVID and the right now, but how do you think about, you know, if those things are installed, the investments are made, what's the value proposition post-COVID, assuming, you know, we all want to get to a post-COVID world. So, you know, for example, you put in video analytics for face mask compliance, but once that's done and you don't need that anymore, can those same technologies be used for demographic data gathering, right? And how do you play that into your marketing, you know, and advertising mix later on? So they've already got it and you know, kind of what do you do with it after the fact, right? So those are the conversations that are happening. But it doesn't mean that all of a sudden budgets are just available, right, to people. A lot of businesses, yeah, as we've seen, especially as Debbie pointed out, in the retail world, are just trying to survive, let alone being able to make investments in new technology.
And are retailers, I'm curious what Beth has to say here, are they finding that budget because they just know they need to?
In some cases, yes, they're finding budget. In other cases, no. I know that might sound like, you know, obvious, but I think if they were budget strapped before COVID, that's probably taking effect during COVID as well. But for those retailers that are CX forward and those who are operationally savvy have been able to come up with at least enough for proof of concept to be able to get something out there, test and learn, figure out what the logistics are around doing, for example, temperature screening and occupancy sensors and things of that nature, and then able to determine, okay, is this only appropriate for back of house? Is this front of house? And then where's the most vital for us to implement? So that's what we're seeing. We're hopeful. We really are. We're seeing movement.
Yeah. And just to comment on what Beth said, so the idea of proof of concept is something that's really big up here, especially in Canada, because what's happening is many of these businesses are able to access funding from government and subsidies and whatnot to go and make investments in technologies right now. Like Shopify, for example, here has launched a program for every small business. If you weren't online before, you can now get online, basically with an online presence, a website, a menu, if you're a restaurant, whatever, all built for free, right? By, you know, government subsidy and Shopify.
That's a very good point.
So there's lots of things like that going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That actually motivates additional investment too. Okay, well, if we're going to get this funding, then we might be able to really, really push the limits of the technology. In fact, I just had a call with a, this is interesting, with a robotics company. They produce robots to automate the way in which essential businesses need to fulfill merchandise. And because this is in the state of Michigan, and because the governor is making funds available, even more so in that state, they're able to push additional AI tools to be able to keep their spaces safe. So that was just an interesting way that they've been able to expand the program.
Beth mentioned CX Forward. I wanted to ask any of you, really. Debbie talked about Party City. Are there other really good examples out there of great consumer experience, customer experience, be that in retail or other types of venues and facilities that you've seen, and why are they great?
Yeah, I mean, well, you've probably all seen the statistics on how well Target has done. So it's hard to argue that they haven't, you know, jumped in and really, you know, taken all of this seriously very quickly. And they've done really well. They're, you know, they're an essential retailer. It helps to be qualified as an essential retailer. I was just thinking, I mean, we're all consumers, so we can all think about some of the experiences that we've had. But I've been impressed with Trader Joe's, for example, from the very beginning. They made it clear what they were doing. So I was in line one day and they closed the register because at a certain time, you know, after a certain amount of time or customers, they're cleaning the register, and you see that happening, you know. And so they've taken it really, and I've had to stand in line to get in. I've had to wait a little while to get in, but it's, you know, you feel better about it when it's clear, you know, what the steps that they're taking. So those are just
totally impressive.
Yeah,
they're a best practice for sure.
Mark, yeah. Me to come back.
Sibel, you were.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting. So the economics, if you look at things like museums, music venues, theme parks. So right now, you know, Brian mentioned, you know, New York museums are opening at 25%. We're seeing some of that with the private museums in Washington. You can't even get a ticket because the demand is so high. So that customer experience is almost like a concierge level. I mean, you have these spaces where normally you're crowded in and, you know, you just feel like you're being pushed through. And now, you know, the behaviors are different. People can spend time. The quality is higher. Imagine going to a theme park and not having these crazy lines. The problem is with that, and I know the Kennedy Center, they just had an article on Washingtonian this month. They're looking at models, right? So that means I have a better experience as a customer, but that's not financially sustainable. And this is the problem that we're going to hit because, you know, museums and music venues and theme parks, you know, take so much to, you know, staffing and everything that it takes to operate. What's great for us as the consumer to kind of have that almost to ourselves, but at some point, there's going to be a tipping point of, you know, what they can sustain from the financial thing. So I think, you know, we may see a trend where the customer experience is really going up. It's a much better experience and people are getting a lot more for their money. But then, you know, how do we see the other end of that where people will expect that kind of experience, but that doesn't really bring in the dollars to sustain these venues.
So prices go up or it doesn't work.
There's something to be said for exclusive events, though. I mean, I've been watching and getting the regular communications from folks like Ticketmaster, you know, offering those interesting, you know, feel like you're in the same room. I've even bought tickets for my son for a magic show where it's a limited number of people on a Zoom meeting like this. I think that's sort of the interesting part of where can we go in the experimentation. Is how great would it be to have that personalized experience inside of a museum where you are, you know, only the elite get walked through, you know, with an instructor? How great would it be to get up close and personal with your favorite celebrity musician? I think that those are the experiences and the experimentation that are really exciting to watch as just a plain old consumer.
Yeah. And I think the way the Kennedy Center said that they're looking at trying to balance that is maybe, You know, you might be on the stage, actually. I mean, they'll have a very small venue, but the way to monetize that is then, is it a hybrid event? So it's some sort of subscription, you know, at a lower price. And then for the people that are in person, they're paying, you know, a premium price. So it's interesting.
So how do we deal with retail and other experiences for all those people who will never or not likely to be able to afford premium pricing and can share luxury kind of experiences? They shop at dollar stores and Walmart and places like that. Are there things that those kinds of businesses can do to offer experience in their own way? We talked about elaborate cleaning and so on, and making a show of that is one thing. Is that really the key, or are there other things? It's a tough one.
I'm glad you brought it up, because that's what I was thinking. I mean, it's great to have those exclusive experiences, but, you know, it's only the top, 5% of the population that could probably afford that, you know. And I know, like, for example, in the past, like the New York City Opera, like, it's a ridiculous amount of money to go to the opera, but they would have programs where they would, invite classes of students to come in and for free or a much lower price. But how is that sustainable for the business? I mean, it's a really scary question right now with our economy the way it is, with the fear of health and safety issues. So I don't know what the answer is, but I'm glad you brought it up, because I was thinking about it.
Well, Debbie, I think back to the Retail Innovation Conference from, I think it was 2 years ago, and you had Fabletics on stage, who talked a bit not only about their business and the way they use analytics, which in and of itself is really unique and cool, but they also talked about moving into brick and mortar and bringing that personalization in store. And that's not a brand that I don't see particularly as luxury. I understand not everybody can afford it, but it's kind of, it's in a normalized price range. How are retailers like that performing, where you can't get that anywhere else? It's not like going to Target, where you can get every brand or everything, or going to Walmart and getting everything. I think there's something there.
Yeah, there's a concept that I just heard about. Sorry, there's a fly flying around me. Called Retail Closet, and just specifically, retailers have to and are looking at smaller spaces that can be personalized, that can be regionalized and localized for groups. Also partnerships. They have to start looking at partnerships with other brands and other retailers so that they can maybe share spaces, share costs. So they just have to get creative with what the future looks like. And absolutely, omnichannel has to be part of it. You need to be, if you're not selling online, or through mobile or e-commerce in some way at this point, you're going to be in trouble down the road. So that definitely has to be part of it also. But I think there are going to be some interesting, different uses of space. That's one of the sessions that we're trying to put together for this innovation conference, is, some experts in real estate and different ways to think about what the future of physical retail is going to look like.
That regional localization, and we're hearing a lot of the same in the trade show world out there. Instead of having a large national event, there's talk that there will be regional events, or possibly even local events to replace those, just to be able to have the smaller group of people and a more one-to-one connection.
More bad news for airlines.
We've got enough women on this call. I'll ask. How do you buy makeup anymore? It's one thing to buy clothes, but
you could have asked me.
Tell me, really? Dave, how do you buy foundation?
I don't.
I'd like to answer that, actually.
Oh, good.
I have been moving towards eco brands.
Uh-oh, she froze.
See, I really needed to hear this.
I'm on the edge of my seat.
It's one of those things that I think the beauty industry will really transition in this.
We have Rebecca Perkins and Stephanie March, who founded She Spoke. And you all probably know Stephanie March from Law & Order SVU, or She used to be married to Bobby Flay. But they started this makeup company called She Spoke, and they're moving, as we speak, all digital, and they're speaking at our event, and they're talking about how they're personalizing that digital experience to make people.
That should be very, very interesting, because beauty is particularly challenged. And also the AR, you know, augmented reality, virtual kind of concepts in beauty are particularly challenging because they can be perceived as gimmicky. So I think that the technology platforms that support beauty are going to need to be elevated as well during this time, and no doubt it will. So because of
most of them have been done poorly and quickly.
I totally agree. And they're janky.
You have to do it well.
Have to do it well. Some of the eyeglass manufacturers like Luxottica have figured it out, and it's great. There's platforms out there that are sophisticated, but they're an investment. So I'd like to see what the everyday beauty brands do, right? Oh, that are, you know,
this amazing science experiment where we're the guinea pigs.
There we go.
Exactly. No, we got to buy eco-friendly, no plastic. That's my check PSA.
Check out beauty. We're losing all the guys on this call because we're talking about makeup.
So sorry.
They had to bounce to other meetings. we should probably wrap this up soon, but I did want to ask if some of you could provide some basic advice for people who are listening and looking at this. They run a store, they run an organization, they're thinking about consumer and customer experience. What are those kind of baseline foundational things they should be thinking and doing?
I think it's so simple. But think about your customer, and that's how it was before, and it hasn't changed. Your customer's viewpoints have changed, and their needs have changed. You need to keep communicating with them, but it's not just your customers who are buying from you. It's your internal customers as well. It's your staff and employees. That is such a key to having your business be successful moving forward. They need to feel comfortable. They need to feel safe and healthy. And we've all seen this when we've gone into stores lately, you feel like you have a less of a personal relationship with people because you're not even really looking at people in the eye anymore because you're wearing a mask. But if you can tell the people who care about what they're doing, who care about you and, you know, who welcome you, rather than just, you know, do a transaction just because they have to. That comes from the top. That comes from being invested in knowing who your customers are. It's using the data and analytics, also, you know, being invested in your employees.
I would say the two key things from a physical retail store perspective is safety first, and then second, continuous adaptation, because we're in such a time of turmoil in retail, and things are constantly changing, and we've talked, you know, this whole time about the flexibility that's necessary and just really applying the technology, applying the safety, making your customers feel good about the experience and being able to roll off if it's not working.
All right. Thanks, everybody. This was great. Very insightful. That's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed it and you learned a thing or two. If you're new to 16.9, it's a podcast that's been around since 2016. You can click around the site and find scores of conversations with smart industry folks. If you're new to digital signage, you need to be reading 16.9. That's at 16-9.net. You'll find thousands of posts by me and expert guest writers about this industry. I don't run a press release republishing mill. If something makes it on 16.9, that means it matters in some way to the business. Everything about 16.9 is free. Great sponsors make my work possible, and one of those is podcast sponsor ScreenFeed. Check them out at screenfeed.com. 16.9 is a product of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare room in my house, now located outside Halifax, Nova Scotia, on the east coast of Canada. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Haynes.